From AllSport.com and AllSport Magazine, I'm Kevin Turner, and this is the AllSport Retro Podcast. Well, welcome to a new AllSport podcast channel that we've just launched. And as it sounds, we're going to use it to look back at the history of motorsport, teams, drivers, races, championships, well, you name it, off the back, really, of our successful mini-series on Williams with Jonathan Williams and Karun Chandhok that we did at the start of 2025. So we'll have a series of guests. And I'm very pleased to say that joining me is a new to the AllSport podcast author, John Saltonstall. John, how are you doing? Welcome to the AllSport podcast.
Good morning, Kevin, and thank you very much for inviting me. It's great to be on board.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, let's get into it. So it's 50 years since Lella Lombardi famously became the first and still only woman racing driver to score points in the Formula One World Championship, with sixth place at the 1975 Spanish Grand Prix, which is a race we'll come to shortly. But actually, she's someone that deserves a lot more than just talking about that race. She achieved lots of other things, and as you can imagine, against the odds in a very male-dominated world, particularly motorsport in the 1960s and 70s. And John has written a book, Lella Lombardi, The Tigress of Turin, her authorised biography. So the first question, John, before we get into Lella's career is why? Why did you decide to do this project? I think it's an excellent subject, but why did you decide to take it on?
Well, it's bizarre. It's something I wanted to do for over 20 years. I first became aware of Lella back in 1974 when she was racing over here in Formula 5000, and I was just struck by the incongruousness, if you like, of a woman hustling these great big sort of 5 litre behemoths around the likes of Brands Hatch, and thinking, you know, what the hell is happening here? You know, because although I was sort of 10, 11 years old by then, I'd not seen women racing. So this was something strange to me. So I was kind of fascinated by then, and particularly then as her career developed into F1. But then she kind of disappeared off the radar, and it wasn't really until until around the time that her death was announced in the 1990s that I started thinking, well, okay, so what happened between there and then? And I read up a bit about her, but it wasn't until the opportunity came a couple of years ago to really do a proper job on it that I was able to start looking into the career of somebody who's just truly a remarkable driver, really, because, I mean, you hit the nail on the head there where you said statistic of being the only woman to have ever finished an F1 Grand Prix in a point-scoring position, it kind of does her a disservice because it overshadows the complete rest of her career. You know, this is a woman who was Italian Formula 850 champion in 1970, you know, beating some guys who went on to be very successful Formula 2 drivers. She won the Escort Mexico Championship in 73. She was the first woman to ever hold a Formula 1 works contract. She scored the highest post-war finish at Le Mans in an all-female crew since, 1930 was the only time anybody ever did any better. She was the first woman to win an FIA fully sanctioned international race, three times in the World Sports Car Championship. She was Italian Group 6 Sports Car Champion and won many class victories in the European Touring Car Championship. You know, so that's a career that anybody would be proud of, really, I think. That's, you know, she was certainly no slouch when it came to speed. And yet, we don't know anything about her, really. We don't know much about her. We know the statistics of what she did, but getting to know the person was a different thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I think I'm always pleased when what appear to be niche titles and topics come up, because I think they really delve into the proper detail of motorsport and people's lives within it. So I think Lombardi, like lots of, well, whatever your gender or nationality, her interest in motorised transport began at a very early age, didn't it? And she was pretty much the only one in her family with that as well.
Completely, yeah. I mean, just picking up on what you said there, there's a danger, isn't there, that people who are the lesser lights in the sport can be reduced to the, you know, the status of a statistic, and to try and get them into some kind of three-dimensional perspective, because, you know, they're worth more than that, is important. But yeah, Lella's her story's a bit like a Hollywood script. You know, as you say, she was the first person in her family to learn how to drive. Her dad was a butcher. and had a sort of wholesale salami business that operated out of a tiny little village called Frugarolo. So I suppose we ought to say the Tigress of Turin, which is a name that John Webb of Brands Hatch came up with to try and promote her a little bit. But she's not from anywhere near Turin, really. Frugarolo is nearer to Alessandria, but.
That doesn't work as well, does it?
No, really? It wasn't. No, and Webby was smart enough to know that the average British motorsport punter had no idea where Alessandria was, let alone Frugarolo. So Turin was kind of the nearest bigger place, although probably nearer to Genoa than Turin. But she was born in the wartime, grew up in post-war Italy, which was a pretty desolate place, really. It was very poor and a lot of rebuilding to be done. So she learned to drive by driving the butcher's lorry and riding alongside one of the delivery men because neither of her parents could drive. And she also had a very strong interest in scooters. She got herself a little Lambretta when she was a teenager, and she used to challenge the boys to races around the village, invariably beating them. And the village priest was asked by some of the other ladies of the village to go and have a word with her to tame her behaviour. Of course, she took no notice whatsoever.
And quite rightly so, yes. Provided she was responsible on the roads, obviously, we should cover that off. But, I mean, she got into racing in with the Italian F850s, didn't she? And then she kind of got into F3, came back to the 850s again, won the championship in 1970, as you said, and that kind of launched her from there a little bit more.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, she actually started in something called Formula 875, Formula Monza, as it was later named, which was a real sort of entry-level formula that came in 65, which was when she started racing, and it was a real sort of cadet formula that was designed to run on the junior circuit at Monza. And she bought herself a car on hire purchase, partly with help from a family and partly with the help from a girlfriend. And the girlfriend and the fact that Lella was going is one of the reasons, really, that her career has been so hard to research, because you can imagine that for a girl from an Italian Catholic country. Whose career started in 1965, running through to the late 1980s. She was very, very protective about her personal life and very protective about her partner, because it was, the world was a very different place then. So she just shut down any access to her personal life, even to the extent that the journalists who knew her and Fiorenza well enough to go round for tea didn't know Fiorenza's surname. You go ahead and Google now and try and find anything about Lella's partner Fiorenza, and that's all you'll find, that it's Lella's partner Fiorenza. But that's something that we've been able to get behind as well. But you're right. So she did pretty well in Formula Monza, again against some guys who were hot shoes in Formula 3 later. Has a go at Formula 3 as a result, realizes she's overstepped it. Winds back to Formula 850, driving a Biraghi, which was a sort of locally built machine, Fiat engine thing, and wins a championship. She won four races out of the series in 1970, and she was beating people like Alberto Colombo and Giancarlo Nadio, and people who went on to have serious careers in. She didn't race against many F1 guys in those days. But she raced against some, European level F2 guys, and it was that that sort of sprung her back into Formula 3. She had two seasons in Formula 3 in 72-73, did pretty well at the Monaco Formula 3 race in 73, qualified for the final. When there were about, I think there were about 50 entrants or something that year. So to even get into the final was an effort. But she put up a good showing there, and that's when John Webb spotted her. Formula 5000 was kind of a good crowd puller over here in the mid-70s, and Webb recognised that it would be quite a good move promotionally to have a woman racing in that series. So he set her up with a test drive for the Shell Sport Lola team that Jackie Epstein ran. And they won the championship in 72 with Joyce Van Lenner. And she did a good test. You know, she was as quick as anybody that they tested. So they put her in the car. And she just got better and better and better during that season, to the extent that she went over and raced Formula 5000 in America, and also a couple of races in Australia, where she was very big in Australia, very popular in Australia, that really made an impact. She almost won the two races that she did in Australia, had it not been for running out of fuel in one and a broken fuel pump in the other. But Kevin Bartlett, who was an Australian champion and no mean driver, said, you know, she gave us the runaround. She knew what she was doing.
Yeah, we should say at this point, for those that aren't so familiar, obviously John Webb was the sort of master promoter at Brands Hatch and had come up with all sorts of ideas, and Formula Ford brought Formula 5000 to Europe, lots and lots of things over a long period of time. And Formula 5000 itself, stock block V8s, massive great V8 in the back of a single seater. Some of them were almost as quick as contemporary F1 cars, but they were quite took some driving. We've put some young drivers in historic F5000s, and they are quite eye-opening machines. They do shake the ground. So, yes, I can see why that would have been a good crowd pleaser. But she also got her first attempt, didn't she, to qualify for a Grand Prix in 1974?
She did indeed, yes. Hexagon rented a Brabham off Bernie Eccleston for her to drive. It was a sort of year-old car, but she was making a pretty good showing with it, but failed to qualify by a tiny fraction. There's a bit of a story behind it, actually, because the war between Bernie Eccleston, who obviously was the ringmaster of Formula One for a long time. Eccleston was trying to build the Formula One Constructors Association at the time. And there was a dispute going on between Eccleston and the circuit organisers about how many drivers could start the race. The organisers said, well, anybody who qualifies within 110% of the pole time could start. And the Formula One Constructors Association was saying, well, maximum of 24. Eccleston's got a dilemma here because he's manipulated this woman to get an entry into the race. She's qualified 25th, missed the cut by a fraction of a second because of a broken drive shaft. But, you know, he's got a dilemma. Do I go with the constructors who I'm saying does this, or do I let this girl start the race? And in the end, he ended up siding with the Constructors Association and let her in to start. So politics, as ever, played their hand. But she was within a whisker of starting then, but that was good enough to get her noticed. She was particularly noticed by an Italian fellow called Count Zanon. Zanon was the sponsor behind Ronnie Peterson, who was obviously a big name in the 1970s Formula One. And he also, in later years, helped Ayrton Senna buy his way out of his contract with Tolman and go to Lotus. But Zanon was very impressed by the idea of this girl who learnt to drive in the butcher's van, and was sort of throwing these Formula 5000 behemoths around, which, as you say, one of the mechanics said it was, if you imagine swinging a sock with lead in round your head, that's what it was like trying to get him round a corner. He was quite impressed by what she was doing. So he put up the money to get her into the March Formula One team for 1975.
That's right, and I think that probably brings us, doesn't it, pretty much to she did qualify for the first race in 1975, the car broke down, but then the Spanish Grand Prix, that's the kind of the jumping off point, I suppose, for this podcast, although, as I say, her career is much more than that. 1975 Spanish Grand Prix, not a race, I think, in many ways that Formula One would like to remember. Of course, ultimately it was stopped early because of Rolf Stommelin's horrendous accident when a wing came off and he launched and killed five bystanders, and they didn't restart the race. But she kept it all together, didn't she, on a day when lots and lots of drivers either stopped because of the conditions or put it in the wall themselves.
Yeah, it was, as you say, it really was a weekend to forget. You know, the drivers arrived at the circuit and the first thing they find is that the crash barriers aren't screwed together. And in some places, you're just literally ledged against each other. So they refused to practice. The mechanics and the team managers and the crews all went out and tried to help the local workforce bolt these barriers together. And the driver was still refusing to race. But because the paddock at Montjuïc in Barcelona in those days, it was the old Olympic stadium with a big pair of gates on the end of it, the organisers eventually said, well, if you don't race, we'll impound all the kit and all the cars. So they got a gun to the head, really, so they had to race. Emerson Fittipaldi didn't, the world champion. He stuck his hand up and did one lap, went home. But the rest of them all did. There were multiple accidents, as you say. Big first lap, first corner crash. But Lella stayed out of trouble, kept it on the road, stayed in front of a few people. And when Stommelin had his crash, which was about sort of just before half distance, she was running sixth. So consequently, in those days, obviously, you got points for the top six, not for the top 10. So it's even more impressive compared to things today. Incidentally, talking of comparisons between then and today, you were talking about the physicality of driving Formula 5000s. Even a Formula One car in those days was a hell of a lot more of a physical beast than it is today, because there was no power steering, there was no anti-lock brakes, it was a crash gearbox, you know, double declutching everything, much wider tyres, so you've got physical grip. You needed to have a lot of physical strength to drive one of these things. Lella was all a 5'1".
Yeah, not very tall. Although someone like Adrian Newey would love someone that short. He likes to make the cockpits and cars as small as possible, so he would approve of that. But we should also mention, of course, that was the only race, Formula One World Championship race, which is for Jochen Mass, who we understand is fairly poorly at the moment. So we wish him a speedy recovery and hope Jochen's okay. But what I found interesting about Lombardi's finish there, I mean, she'd already said that I'm a racer who is a woman rather than a woman who races, which I rather like. Yeah. Apparently she wasn't also the significance of her scoring being the first female score of a world championship point. She wasn't too bothered by that, was she? Really what her motivation was.
No, she had a complete blind spot when it came to gender, really. She didn't really recognize any kind of male female differential. She certainly wouldn't have agreed with the concept of the Formula One Academy, that's going on at the moment. Or Formula W as its predecessor. She didn't believe in segregated series. She famously said, under the helmet, men and women are the same. So she told a journalist, it had completely bypassed her that she was the first woman to sort of score points in F1. It didn't register for her. Ironically, that finish wasn't her best F1 drive of that year. Robin Hurd, who was the technical director at March, who she was driving for, said that her drive a couple of races later in the German Grand Prix, where she came seventh, was a lot better, was a lot more impressive. She'd been more consistent, she'd been faster, she'd overtaken more people. Had it not been for a puncture, she'd have been in the points again. But I think there were only about two people who didn't get a puncture that day. So, she was the real deal when it came to it. It wasn't just sort of luck or chance or being manipulated into a good car. Far from it.
No, and in fact, the rest of the season after that, it was a bit disappointing, wasn't it? I've heard this sort of story in many different categories over the years, when unless you're an absolute like one of the legends of the sport, you can get out of the car and go, there's something wrong with this, and then everyone strips it down. Unless you're like that, it's quite difficult sometimes, isn't it, to get the team to really listen and not just think you're making excuses. But Lella did flag a problem, didn't she, that March didn't pick up on, or didn't investigate, perhaps is the better way of putting it, for a little while.
You're absolutely right. With the her biggest complaint was that people didn't listen to her. She didn't complain about the way the other drivers treated her, it was people didn't listen. So to try and cut a very long story short, the chassis of the March that she had been driving, she complained that it handled very strangely. When she turned into a corner, it understeered in, and then halfway around the corner, it snapped into oversteer coming out. And she complained about this from every race after Monaco. And the team was just, well, it's you. They even suggested Brambilla, her teammate, tried it. And he said, oh, yeah, there's not long wrong with this, but he might have had his own reasons. The this carried on for the rest of the season. And after the end of the year, she was dropped to the first race of 1976 because Ronnie Peterson, of whom we spoke earlier, wanted to come back to March. So March basically sacked Lella and put Ronnie back in the car. And Ronnie complained about the exact same behaviour with the car that Lella had complained about until he crashed it in the Belgian Grand Prix. He was punted off. They gave him a new car for Monaco, which he then put on the front row. And he said, well, that's how it should have been. What was wrong with the other one? So Max Mosley, who was the boss of March, ordered the old chassis, which he had taken over from Lella, to be stripped down. And they found that an internal bulkhead was cracked through. So the chassis was flexing as it went through corners. So everything that Lella had described was basically fact. And Robin Hurd said a few years later, you know, I think we wrecked her career.
Were you able to speak to anyone about that directly, or did you have to? Because there were not many of them left, is there, from those days, unfortunately.
I chatted to an awful lot of March mechanics, fabricators, and people who worked on the squad. There's a lot of stuff that they will tell you. There's a lot of stuff that people won't go on the record for. We do know that there were things going on, like swapping of chassis plates. Which was, reasons for everything to do with getting travel car names right, or even just telling drivers that it was a different car they were getting. But yeah, after hours and hours of research and talking to lots of people who should know, the conclusion that we've got to is that the car that had the damage is not the one that is reported elsewhere, because Lella actually ostensibly used three different chassis that year. But what it is it was a chassis that Brambilla had actually shunted earlier on in the year that was given to her as a new car after her crash at Monaco. It never was a new car. It was a bodged together one. It had this inherent problem that was later discovered. When she complained about it between Britain and France, she was ostensibly given a different chassis, but actually it was the same one with a different chassis plate on.
Oh my goodness! Wow.
So she was, she was sold a pup all the way down the line, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone who's into their F1 history would argue that Ronnie Peterson rejoining March was a good move from March's point of view. Absolutely, as a team leader, one of the top runners at the time. But what seems a shame?
I don't think any team wouldn't have taken him instead of one of their drivers.
Exactly. But what is a shame, obviously, is that because I guess Lombardi's results had fallen away with that troublesome March, she didn't really get much of a chance, did she? She got her 12th and final championship outing came in a Ram Brabham at the 76 Austrian Grand Prix. But that was kind of it for F1, wasn't it? That's a bit of a shame. Just when she was getting a bit of momentum, it was sort of cut down in the second half of 75.
Yeah. Her year of 76 is a real bizarre one of extremes. You know, she starts the year as a works F1 driver. Middle of the year, she's driving in a Citroën 2CV rallycross race in France and Italy. You know, there aren't many people who've got those extremes in their career. But she was also racing in sports cars. She'd been racing in sports cars since 1974, quite successfully. She'd partnered Marie-Claude Beaumont at Le Mans in 75, and they've been highly competitive. In 76, they did very well in class, her and Christine Dacremont in a Lancia Stratos, completely unsuited to Le Mans. You know, it was a special purpose-built rally car. Why are you taking one of those to Le Mans? But she'd been a works driver for Renault Alpine. And that kind of opened the door into the next chapter concurrently with going into touring cars. So in 77, 78, she went into racing in the smallest class of the European Touring Car Championship. And at the same time as starting to race little 2-litre Azzella sports cars in the Italian and European championships and in Interserie, which was a German sports car championship. And she was immediately one of the front runners. Up to the point where in 1979, the World Sports Car Championship by then had sort of polarised into two different classes. There were the big sort of Group 5 Porsche 935
Silhouette cars. Yeah.
Silhouette cars, yeah. You know,
it's a 911. No, it isn't.
Absolutely not. It's an absolute beast. And then 2 litre prototypes, the sort of things that you would have seen racing at Le Mans with the open cockpit, closed wheel things. And she was racing in those, and that's what the World Sports Car Championship was for in 79. And she won the Coppa Florio at Enna in 1979. And in doing so, that's when she became the first woman to win an international FIA registered race, the first woman to do so.
And she did win a couple of other races for Acela as well, didn't she? I wanted to sort of put to you was, I think it's probably fair to say that sports car racing was going through a little bit, as you say, it was split. It wasn't as competitive as it had been before and would be again. So would it be fair to say that her performances subsequently in touring cars, particularly with Alfa Romeo and the European Touring Car Championship, was a pretty big deal and actually ended up getting World Touring Car Championship status, of course, for 1 year in the late 80s. Would that perhaps, is that perhaps a better gauge of her abilities than the sports car wins?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, she was racing against some decent opposition in sports cars. She was racing against the likes of Riccardo Patrese, Alessandro Nannini, Alboreto, so she was racing against some decent people. But you're right, it certainly wasn't at the peak that it had been, a few years previously. But yeah, in touring cars, she was racing in some serious names and some seriously competitive stuff. When she went back into the ETCC in 1981, she partnered an Italian rally driver called Anna Cambiaki, who she'd raced with a couple of times previously. So if you've got two girls who are going into the ETCC, what do you give them to drive? I know. How about a Chevrolet Camaro? two tons of American metal with a great big beefy 5-plus-litre engine that Luigi Racing in Belgium prepared for them. And, she said for the first few races, they really hoped that the little cars didn't overtake them into the corners because they weren't stopping. The thing had no brakes, and if somebody went ahead of them, they were going to take it out. But they hustled this thing around and did some pretty impressive showings in 81. And in 82, she switched over to she used to drive for an organisation called the Jolly Club, which was an Italian sporting organisation that ran several teams, a lot of rally stuff as well. But they ran pseudo works Alfa Romeos GTV6s, which is a beautiful car, lovely V6 engine, in the Division 2 of the European Touring Car Championship. And she raced with a succession of very capable co-drivers like Giorgio Francia, Giancarlo Nadio, and Ronaldo Girandi, and won a lot of class victories in that against some pretty competitive opposition. Her and Dravandi were the Division 2 title takers in 85.
Well, she contributed significantly, didn't she, to the Alfa Romeo class success during that period, because they did rack up a few titles and things. It was, as you say, there was one of them sounding very nice, although not going very quickly, at the Goodwood members meeting that I was at a couple of weeks ago. It was fantastic to see. But she wasn't just about the driving, was she, in the 80s? She also decided to set up her own team, Lombardi Autosport. So what was the thinking behind that? Was that a sort of a plan for after she was going to retire?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, the thing that surprised me when I was researching her was just how good a test and development driver she was. It was a recurring theme all the way through from the early 70s that everybody who worked with her said she was really, really good on mechanical sympathy, understanding the car, knowing what he was doing, setting up the car for other drivers, much better than a lot of the people who you might have thought would be the yardsticks there. And that was one of her key roles when she was with Alfa Romeo, was developing and setting up the car, but also helping to develop the drivers that she was working with. And she kind of wanted to put something back from the way that she'd had her apprenticeship back with Formula Monza back in the 60s. So she had this vision of setting up her own team with the mechanic that she'd worked with when she was driving the Alphas that were prepared by Elio Imberti. So, unfortunately, around the time that this was all happening, she had a sailing accident in 1985, where she was hit by the boom of the dinghy that she was helming, that hit her in the chest, and she suffered pain consistently for a long while afterwards, and she just put the pain down to the fact that she'd been hit by this boom. But by 1985-86, tests revealed that that wasn't why she got the pain. She'd actually got breast cancer. And she was eventually forced to retire from racing in 1988 because she didn't have the stamina to do the length of a touring car race anymore. So she moved over to run her own team. So her and Bruno Raimondi, who was the mechanic that she brought from Imberti with her, they set up Lella Lombardi Autosport by then, bringing on young Italian driving talent through the national championship in Touring. They won national championships in their first year and the next year in touring cars. But her health deteriorated quite quickly after that, and then she died in 92 at the age of 50. Which was a bit of a shocker, really.
Yeah, it's not very old at all, is it? Very, very sad. But I'm going to put you on the spot slightly, sort of finish on a bit of a high, in that what would you pick out, having done more research than anyone else, I'm sure, on Nella Lombardi, what would you pick out as her best driving moment then? Was it that 1975 German Grand Prix? Was it one of the sports car wins? What do you think was a highlight?
I reckon her best race would have been either of the two Formula 5000 races in Australia in 1974. So in 74, the front runners of the Australian 5000 season were Max Stewart and Kevin Bartlett. And she'd beaten Bartlett fair and square. She was running second. She was hunting down Stewart for the win. There were about two laps left. She was closing on him and the car ran out of fuel, basically because somebody hadn't put enough in it. So I reckon that was possibly the best drive of her career. These were great big physical things to drive. She was roughing it up against some fairly, boisterous driving. These were the days when the guys would hang a wheel off the edge of the track to throw stones at the person behind them and make them drop back or try and puncture their radiator or something. And, yeah, she wasn't having any of that. But yeah, there was a lot more to her. For a woman who couldn't speak much English, she was pretty good at one-liners. When an English journalist said to her about the Formula 5000, there was a thing in the 70s where a journalist would go out and try and drive one of these things and then write a report about it for Autosport or whatever. One of the guys from Motoring News said to her, "You need to be a truck driver to drive one of those." And she said, "I am a truck driver. You've seen the muscles I've got."
And the delivery van background as well, going all the way back to the start.
Which went to that, yeah. Well, a similar thing happened in 1977. She did a NASCAR race. So she did the Firecracker 400 at Daytona in 1977. So again, these great big two-ton, American muscle cars. And some American redneck journalist says to her, "What's a little itsy bitsy girl like you do? How's a little itsy bitsy girl like you drive one of these great big muscle cars?" And she said, "I have to drive it. I don't have to carry it."
Yes, as you say, some good one-liners there. Some of those should be on T-shirts, shouldn't they? That'd be rather good.
Relic, yeah.
But yes, well, I mean, it's worth saying that Lella Lombardi is still the only female points scoring world championship F1 history. We hope, obviously, after 75 years, that changes rather soon. Various initiatives trying to encourage more girls into karting.
It's quite a sobering statistic, actually, isn't it, Kevin? Because if you think about it, since F1 started in 1950, I know Grand Prix racing goes back to 1906, but F1 started in 1950. There's been give or take 900 people who've tried to qualify. Five of them have been women. Two of them actually qualified. One scored a point.
The numbers are off, aren't they? It's a numbers game, isn't it? Yeah, so that's what we're trying to address with various things now. Well, look, John, thank you very much for joining us and running us through Lele Lombardi's career. It seems only fair to ask you, when is the book out and how do we get hold of one?
Well, hopefully we'll be out in the autumn with it. I had a great conversation with the publishers yesterday. We're trying to get everything finalised now to get it in for the autumn. We're hoping autumn this year. As soon as I've got some more, I'll give you some details that you can pop up the link on the site.
Yes, please do. And actually, anyone who wants a sort of a taster of that, John very kindly wrote us an article for the May issue of Autosport magazine with some great old pictures as well. Helped us out with that. So hopefully we did. Hopefully we've marked this this anniversary of Nello Lombardi's career suitably. So thank you very much, John. Hopefully we'll try to come up with another reason for you to have you on at some point in the future. Best of luck with the book. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us. We'll be back soon with another All Sport Retro podcast.